I'm Ralph Williams. I'm a senior engineer for General Electric down in Philadelphia. And when the planning for this year's Intercon started, I was asked if I would be interested in organizing a session. And it seemed like a real good opportunity to bring some emphasis to a field that apparently doesn't get very much publicity and very little understanding in general in the design process. Now, by that I mean the process by which an engineer makes up his mind that a particular choice is the best of a family of alternatives that he has, where he exchanges information with a computer on a more or less real-time basis and uses the kind of advanced techniques that this session particularly addresses. Now, I suppose it's a publicity relationship that should be emphasized, and yet it's the kind of people that are familiar with terminal equipment, with the art, with the science, and with the application that become the publicists. And so I thought we might take this opportunity to do, among other things, an exchange of information that would help us all to understand better how the interactive graphic activities benefit and enhance the overall design process. So that sort of starts as kind of one of the objectives. Another one, of course, is to report developments that are taking place and to portray particular facilities and the background understanding that has led to them, so that what one learns can be transferred to another. And to that end, we have several papers. The very first one will be with Bob Dunn, and he's from the Signal Corps. He's going to tell us a little bit of the work that's going on down at Fort Monmouth. The second one is Rene Busquet from Lockheed, who's put together a terminal facility. And a very interesting point in this connection, his work is entirely, at this moment, in stress calculations. And for electronic engineers, I suspect that that may sound a little bit strange. One of the very important points here, then, that we would like to be sure gets across is that interactive terminals, the art of using a computer in the design process, is not confined to the thing being calculated by any means. And what's learned in one field is almost immediately transferable to another. As you're watching what Rene has to say, I hope some of us will be thinking of field theory and still others, other applications of the computing process and the direct engineering work that comes about. Now, in digging around during the past year, I found that most every engineer has had some sort of batch experience with a computer. And some, in particularly larger engineering organizations, have the opportunity to work on manual terminals that they have some experience with programming and using subprogramming that's available in a major terminal. But virtually none have any experience at all with respect to the use of a interactive graphics facility. What little apparent publicity I had uncovered or familiarity on the part of the engineers I've talked to was sort of like, oh yeah, those are those things the drafting people use as drafting aids or as some kind of drawing machines. That's bad news, because that's a very limited application. It almost doesn't serve interaction at all. And then there's another place, of course, that you run into, and everybody that's ever laid out an IC has either yearned for a terminal or made use of some kind of a facility to lay out the thing, you know, and use the libraries that are available. But again, that's no way to exchange information with a machine if the process is a design process where decisions have to be made, or if subsequently, and it's an experiment where postulated data is put together to discover whether or not that leads to some kind of a conclusion that is tenable with respect to the end product. So we are going to try and emphasize applications different from drafting aids while recognizing that that's an important part. And one point here is that if a facility exists that does, for example, drafting aid, it is a very large part of the way toward the design process if you, the user, want to go the rest of the way in the reapplication of the broader application and the reprogramming that's necessary to handle your particular kind of data and to aid you in the creative expression of your particular kind of hypothetical work. Now, a key point that turned up in this investigation that I did was that the creative power and the utility is almost not clear to anybody except the folks that have had the pleasure of working on a terminal. We had hoped to have three speakers, and we still hope, but we aren't too sure about the third one yet. Bill Walsh from the University of California has done a great deal of work in that in Berkeley in with his students in their laboratory in actually using their terminal in many different ways to solve problems all the way across the university's scope, many that at first don't appear to yield to any graphics process. When you can reduce them to some sort of a graphics process, as an example, demographic calculations, transportation system layout, can be reduced to mapping if you can map in a complex frame. And this is some of the work that they have done. Well, we hope to bring you examples there to emphasize the potential that the system has and to try and encourage the growth of ideas about how this kind of system might be applied in your everyday work and then put pressure on, for example, to modify any terminal that might come to your attention and to make that available in a broader sense. If we can then encourage you to respond to the papers at the terminal end, we would sort of like to have a discussion, not in a panel format, but rather in a question and answer format, where you may want to question the speakers, or you may want to expound on some application that you have, or even to ask in a limited sense for a critique. So perhaps at the terminal end of this, we could even get some floor speakers. If you are encouraged if you would like to do that. Now, as the first presentation, we have Bob Dunn, who got his background education in mathematics. He's a Rutgers man, and then the Moore School, a word for Philadelphia. Right? And some 12 years ago, he went to work for the Signal Corps in computing systems. About 69, he was responsible to put together the early concepts that has led to their complex terminal facilities now. And about 1972, the early part of it, their developmental testbed came online. Now, the way he works, he spawns services to other people. He's going to kind of outline the general aspects of the decision-making process he has to go through, and then illustrate, tell you a little bit about the work that they're doing specifically. So, first speaker is Bob Dunn.
Am I alive? Okay. Ralph used an interesting word in his introduction. He used the phrase computing process. That term happens to turn me on, and it's a key idea to the way we've approached some things. For us, computing is a process, and interactive computer graphics within that broad sense is a more specialized process. And as such, the process has a purpose, and which is a very obvious one: computational power, speed, and the record-keeping of ability of the computers as an assist to a variety of things that are associated with dealing with images, regardless of what the images deal with, and regardless of what they represent. The image is an abstraction. nothing specific in mind. Ralph alluded to some examples in an area that there are many specialized systems that are called design assistants. There are some others. He mentioned drafting, there's layout design, animation. There are a number of companies who are doing some very elegant things in interactive graphics preparation of computer animation systems. Model building, concept formulation and evaluation, detail design specification, performance simulation, and countless others. One author that I know of took the time to try and exhaust his mind and the mind of some of his colleagues, and they got tired after they had listed 200 distinct different applications, and this was over a year ago, that they then knew about for interactive computer graphics. Now, the first point I think that I should make is that if computing is a process, and interactive computing is a process, computer graphics also has some sub-processes that are very relevant to us. There are three that are particular concern. One is the composition formation of images. Another is concerned with the manipulation or transformation of these images. And the third is concerned with the process of linking these other two to higher order processes that are performed by either people or machines. Now, that's the interaction portion, and in the literature it's referred to as attention handling. Rather than try and give you a lot of block diagrams of equipment, which I found to be unfeasible because there are 60-some different vendors that I know of in the business, I tried to break down the concept of interactive graphics systems and graphics system functions from a systems function point of view and put together a relationship between them. And that's what's illustrated for you here. In general, the system can have a variety of implementations, but it'll always have these five functions. They may not all exist on the same piece of hardware, and the pieces of hardware on which they do exist may be spread over half a continent or more, but they'll all be there for any kind of usage that one makes of interactive graphics. In a little more detail, let's see, we got an error in the slide. That should be output right there, as the arrow indicates. That output function is the process which generates the image for the user to see. Obviously, the input is where he's got joysticks and buttons and wheels and knobs and keyboards and all things like that, for which he can generate either notation or position or transition information, or he can tap the system on the shoulder and say, "Pay attention to me." The graphics function is where those graphics processes that I pointed out earlier are carried out. Up there is there's the big computer primarily, if there is a big computer involved. If you're doing stress analysis or circuit analysis or performance simulation or what have you, typically that's what we're talking about up here. The things which are not really graphically related, but which represent the purpose for having graphics as an interactive terminal. And then there are all kinds of data, the images themselves, the data that's extracted from the images, the programs that they get used with, and so on, and that's over at the storage function. And as we'll see later on, the storage function can be spread all over the place. It can be either local with the console or with the big computer or what have you. There is one important point that I'd like to leave with you, other than the fact that there are these five functions and they always have this relationship, and that is that the relations are ones of data flow within a total system. And it's a very key idea from my point of view, because it says a lot about how you can organize systems when you're dealing with particular hardware. Now, let me say that again. The basic notion here is that the relations are one of data flow between specialized functions in an overall system. Now, we claim that the whole reason for interaction in the first place is to get the human in the computing loop. He becomes a process controller, more or less, and a decision maker in an ongoing process. And you can talk to 100 different people in computing, and about half of them will tell you something's interactive and the other half will disagree. And why are we concerned with this notion of interaction, and why the disagreement? Well, it turns out that the reason for the disagreement is a matter of the degree of human involvement and the viewpoint from which that involvement is assessed, and towards what purpose one wants to append the label interactive. Now, in today's marketing environment, many of the vendors would like to call anything at all interactive. On the other hand, many users who have no marketing concerns at all for equipment, they get quite staunchly adamant when someone says something is interactive and it's not really from their point of view. So for us, there's a relative notion, and that is interactive is a rate that's both useful and satisfying to the human. Now that's about as ambiguous as hell. And the whole brunt of this paper this morning is to try and bring across an idea of what do we mean by useful, what do we mean by satisfying, and how the devil can we measure that thing. It's as elusive as it can be, and I don't know of anybody who's done a good job of it yet, and I'm not sure that we've got one here, but we've taken a whack at it. It's the value judgments that we place on useful and satisfying that determine the manner in which a given computer-based system should incorporate interactive graphics. And in order to get at an idea of equipment configurations, we must understand the types of usages to which interactive graphics can be put and the various configuration alternatives that are available when one thinks about implementing. Now, we talked about a lot of examples, drafting and design assistance and problem solving and whatnot. But if you step back a little bit and you try and see if these things group in any way that's topic independent, from my view, we have three basic classes or types of usage. One is where there is a simple I/O process that's going on that's being improved from the human's point of view. The second is where we're concerned with the detailed specification of something. This is the role of the design assistant that many of you are familiar with. And finally, we have the class of problems, the class of applications, which are called problem solving, which has a peculiar characteristic that I'll go over. Now, in the I/O process, this is the first and most obvious and often the most economical area in which to attack the application of interactive graphics. Any of you who've tried to use computers through punch cards or teletypes, I haven't yet learned how to file my teeth so I can mark sense those cards well. And I really don't care for 10 or 30 characters a second on a teletype. I'm a lousy typist, and I can't spell worth a damn. And so just improving the simple interface for getting information into the machine from the man and getting it out from the machine to the man in the widest bandwidth channel that he's got is one of the major and most significant areas of the application of interactive graphics. And of course, one of the most obvious ones is in management information systems, where reports can be put up for staffs to managers or the managers themselves, where they can scan quickly through information over which they have a wide latitude and flexibility of selection. The specification process is, let me just dwell on the I/O process for just a moment. In addition to all the good things that can be said about it, I should say that there is a disadvantage. Graphics is expensive, there's no question about it. And I dare say it'll always be more expensive than any other form of input-output. And the judgment is going to have to be, you know, how much of a bang do you want for your buck in terms of the input-output? And we'll get to how one can form those kinds of judgments a little later. And the other point is that graphics is not only expensive from an equipment acquisition and software point of view, but at least as we now implement graphics systems, they pretty much burden the computer system with some extra processing that timeshared systems are very reluctant to yield because they hurt other kinds of non-graphic usage. And there's a third problem that I'll get to when we talk about this process a little bit more. In the specification process, the major concern here is one of a combined function of data entry and data editing, and I'm mostly focusing on complex data. Now, let me read what I mean by complex data. That is, it's intricate, it has inherent requirement for a high degree of accuracy, it's either highly structured or has precise interrelationships amongst the data elements. And if you think of networks and structural layouts, and masking patterns and a lot of other things, demographic data, they all have that characteristic. And layout design for integrated circuits, design drafting for mechanical, structural, or aerospace systems, design of animation sequences, and even something like fitting mathematical functions to empirical data, all have the characteristic that I'll lump into the specification process. The advantage here is that the current status or representation of the data that's being worked on is portrayed dynamically back to the human via the image that he's seeing. And this image provides for a continuous online review of the specification that he's generated so far. This feedback is tremendous. It gives him an opportunity to see his mistakes quickly before he wastes the computer's time to compute. And it channelizes the kinds of alternatives that he will select amongst for the next activity at that interaction. And he can make these judgments prior to entry if he cares to. In highly interactive systems in which the application is very well defined, the human can not only be prevented from making an invalid choice, but he can instantly see the system's rejection of his choice. Either nothing happens or it gives him an unkind and unflattering remark about his competence. There are disadvantages here too. The ones which I mentioned for the I/O process certainly pertain, but that third problem is now very important. And it's particularly important in computing. We tend to be very much concerned with the fastest, the best, the greatest, etc. And I haven't encountered a computer professional who's not absolutely in love with saving a microsecond in his lovely machine, and he could care less whether he's going to cost someone an enormous amount of time in doing so. It's as though they can't get through their heads that the machines are virtually inexhaustible by comparison to the people. And there's an enormous amount of energy that's spent to reduce the amount of burden on the computer. And this is as true in interactive graphics as it is anywhere else, and the result is that system and application programmers refine and reduce the response time for graphics interaction so that virtually instantaneous, and let's put quotes around that, virtually instantaneous response, it's only a press of a light switch away, you know, just about like so, with the light here. And in terms of continuing and to improve the I/O process and the interaction rate, that's very good. In the use of the system as a design assistant, however, this can be highly disastrous. And all you have to do is ask any poor soul who's had to sit down in front of a large, high-capacity system with instantaneous response, and his job is to put together a detailed layout design of something that's very complicated. My favorite example is some fellows that I saw once at McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis working in their design drafting system. This poor soul is working on a wing for one of their fighter aircraft. And he was at a great big system and a great big console, and it was a dilly. They had spent $10 million in 5 or 6 years, and who knows, just to develop the system, and who knows how much was there in backing it up in computers. The system responded so fast, and he was so conscious of the cost involved in supporting his interaction, that after about an hour, he walked away with a headache. If he had tried to stay at that console for 2 hours, they would have led him away babbling. And one of the things they've had to do is slow that down a little bit. The interaction pressure gets so fast that the user is forced, he feels compelled to try and keep up with the machine. Well, you know, I really haven't met any of the super types who can do that yet. There might be one out there someplace, but I haven't encountered any, and I don't expect I will before too long. And in that specification process, it's a dilly of a job because the user's got to keep... The reason he's there is that he knows all the interrelationships between the complex pieces in his thing, whether it's an aircraft wing or a circuit or what have you. And he's got to keep track of it. If he's pressured, he not only will have a psychological problem, but he's going to blow up in the quality of his work. And there is a lurking third danger in the use of interactive graphics. One must try to tailor the systems and literally slow them down to match the interaction rate, and we'll talk about that later too, to the needs of the process which is being supported and the kind of people who will be carrying out that process. The third type of use is the problem-solving use, down here in the bottom. And by this I mean we're going to do I/O input-output. We're going to do the I/O process as part of it. We're going to be doing some specifications also. But there's an additional set of characteristics which set it apart. Here, the human needs to perceive, alter, or assess the representation and behavior of performance, usually time-related, of a system for which some design specification has already been created and is being retained by the computer. When time-related, the behavior or performance of concern may vary either continuously or in discrete time steps. Motion, color variation, structural deformation, or any other attribute or combination may be used as a significant representative of the behavior of the system. Well, that's all very nice, but what does it mean? Let's take that design draftsman again, doing his aircraft wing, but instead of the design draftsman, let's put the aircraft designer there. And instead of having the internal details of the structure and the hydraulic systems of the aircraft wing, let's just look at the airfoil characteristics, its sweepback angle, and the placement in its connection to the fuselage. And the designer is concerned with properties like aerodynamic lift, drag, turbulence, etc. And in one system, which is pretty well developed, and I think Dave Prinz has mentioned it in his book, it's down at Lockheed, Georgia, the designer sits at the terminal. He sketches out the profile of his wing. He gives it its airfoil characteristic and its sweepback angle. And then with the light pen, he fixes on the tip of that wing and begins to move it. And as he does, the screen is put into quadrants, and he sees the dynamic behavior of the properties of that wing design. And he sees that interactively. He sees the curves which represent the turbulence, drift, lift, drag, whatever is of interest to aircraft wing designers. And so in that kind of environment, we'll call that the problem-solving process. The specification has already been accomplished at some level. The input-output barrier has already been overcome. And the human is trying to look for significant things of relevance to his problem. The essence of it is that there is an observation and evaluation of parametric variations. Sometimes the parameters are set up by the user, sometimes they're set up by the machine. Different problems will have different approaches to varying these parameters and with some regularity or randomness. A fellow by the name of Alexander, he's Christopher Alexander, he's an architect at MIT, wrote a book a number of years ago on synthesis of form. And he was concerned with trying to convey to architects, how do you know that you've got a good design? How do you know that the design you're trying to achieve will do whatever it's supposed to do? And he identified something called the misfit variable, or the concept of the misfit variable. He says, you don't always know when you've got a good design, but you sure as hell know when you've got a bad one. And the problem is to try and find out what makes it bad. And that bad thing is what Alexander calls the misfit variable. And it turns out in problem solving, that's really what we're doing most of the time. We're trying to hunt up that misfit variable. What is not letting the design achieve its purpose? And so we've got to be able to play or toy with the design. And the interactive graphic capability is a lovely way to do it. Again, there's a caution. I don't know how many of you are scuba enthusiasts or deep sea diving enthusiasts, but there's something known as rapture of the deep. You know, you go too far and you're completely disoriented and you keep on diving and pretty soon you're lost forever to humanity. I think that happens with interactive graphics too. You get so wrapped up in it that you forget what you're supposed to be doing and the beauty of it all overwhelms you. That can get very expensive very quickly and your management is likely to have a few words. Another problem with the problem-solving process use of interactive graphics is that there's an awful lot of information which is highly structured other than the design specification. And in order for the interaction to go on very smoothly, the information has to be organized very well. In computer terminology, this is called data structures. And the data structure capability which supports the interactive graphics process is essential and very important and quite critical for the problem-solving process. Robin Williams at New York University in Computing Surveys about a year or two ago had a very nice article that I would recommend to all of you on the alternatives and characteristics of data structures as they apply to interactive graphics. So much for the uses. That kind of sets the context of what we're talking about. And remember, these are classes. Within these, there are almost endless variations. But they do have distinctly different impacts on the kind of configuration and the kind of interaction. The next thing to consider is the way in which we can configure a system. Again, I refused to deal with 67 different vendors' hardware alternatives. I don't think that's relevant. I couldn't cover it, and I don't think I could make much sense out of it. But if I go back to those five functions and the relationships between them that I illustrated earlier, I believe I can give you some sense of what different configuration alternatives there are and what their good and bad points are and their limitations, liabilities, difficulties, and costs. And so that's what I'll try and do for you. Now, first of all, as a heuristic, these circles and the lines represent those five functions. I didn't think you'd like to read all that junk all over again. This is a standalone system. It says that all the five functions are usually co-located. All the hardware and all the software that's necessary to make this system work has one essential characteristic, and that is that they are totally and completely dedicated to the graphics function during the user's interactive session at the console. There's no sharing, there's no nothing. It's an enormously powerful tool. It can be very expensive if you've got the wrong application for it. But when that user is online, everything that's there in the computer system for all five of the functions is completely dedicated to the user system. Now, there are mini processors which are set up as standalone systems, and there are major computer systems which are put into a mode which is equivalent to a standalone capability for graphics in various ways. So it doesn't necessarily relate to the size of the system. It relates to the way the system is operated in support of the user while he's at the console. They can support any type of interactive graphics use for any kind of function, and their goodness is a function of the computational support capacity. If you've got a mini computer that's doing the application and storage functions up here, you're not about to do the structural analysis of a nuclear warhead on that thing or a complex electronic control system. On the other hand, they are not limited by the inherent hardware characteristics of the graphics console, because we can approximate these things in software if the features aren't in the hardware. And we can use programming to make up for what the hardware does not provide. Now, there is a significant difference between the standalone and all the other configurations, which I'll explain. The differences are reducible to factors of the productivity of use, the difficulty of use, and the sophistication of the graphics mechanisms and costs. And I'll keep coming back to those terms as I go through all the other configurations. The next configuration is something that we'll talk about as a simple I.O. device. In the non-graphic world, most of you are familiar with this as a teletype. There's no super logic at the teletype. You've got a keyboard and a printer, a printing device of some kind, and a telephone line, and all the logic for everything is back at the main computer. And that's what this little glitch around the man is supposed to mean. All of the storage functions, applications, graphics processing, the problem of generating the image, the problem of deciding what to do about any inputs that have been entered by the man, these are all done someplace else. The major point here is not whether or not they're connected by telephone line or coax or direct coupled, because all of those are possible in a simple I.O. device situation. The major point is that the main computer, as opposed to the standalone, is shared. The user on that terminal is not alone in his activity on the system at that instant in time. And as a consequence, he's going to compete for the computing resources which are supporting the interactive graphics process. And that's a significantly different characteristic to the use and to the kind of service he'll get, depending upon how graphics is being supported. It's probably the cheapest way to get involved with graphics, I might point out. Just get a little terminal which has got some data communications interface and hang it out there, and you're in business. But it may not be the most cost-effective. The buffered I.O. system is an extension of the simple I.O. device. And here, the process of actually causing the image to occur on the surface, the imaging surface, the screen in this case, and of physically accepting the signals and deciding what's it going to do about them at the first stage, this is taken care of local to the console. And I've got two lines here, because what's important is that some part of the graphics functions, that is the manipulation, transformation, or attention handling, is always done in the main system and not on the local terminal. In some cases, it's all of it. In some cases, it's part of it. And so there's two ways in which one can achieve a buffered I/O device configuration. You get pretty good performance out of this. It's a little more expensive. It imposes less of a burden on the computing system because a lot of the logic for just the simple input-output functions are taken care of local to the console, and the headaches of tiny detail handling is removed from the big computer. But if you split that function, now you've got a real big problem, because one side of that function has got to communicate with the other side of it, and your programmers better know what they're doing, and you better have pretty good system support. Otherwise, you're in a mess as far as response, and you really may not have an interactive system after all. It's a little bit more expensive, as I said. The intelligent terminal is an overused word, but it's pretty good as far as describing what we mean. Here, we've got the graphic system's function completely out of the main system. The input and the output are controlled locally also. In both the buffered systems and in the intelligent terminal, you might have either mini processors or special purpose processors local to the hardware, to the console hardware. But what the extent of these things are will depend upon how the system is set up. I know of at least one system where there's a 30-bit long word and 32,000 words of it that are performing those functions at the terminal. On other systems, there are just 4,000 or 5,000 words of slave memory that are attached to buffer out the information. In the intelligent terminal, the concern for what does an interruption mean, how is an image to be formed, how is it to be manipulated, that's done locally. There aren't many low-cost intelligent terminals in terms of absolute dollar outlay, and as such, they're usually reserved for very, very difficult areas or very high capacity requirements. Again, this is the first configuration in which the remote system, that is the main shared system, really isn't concerned with the fact that it's got a graphics problem hanging off of it, because most of the concern for graphics has been stripped away. Perhaps in the data structure, one is still concerned that you've got a graphics, but that's implicit in the data structure rather than explicit in anything that the system is doing. Perhaps the only other thing in the main system which knows that graphics is around is a priority associated with the graphics support functions, so that if the operating system up here knows that this thing out here is a graphics, maybe it'll take it in a little sooner to give it some time. One step up is a problem of multiple users. Most of the configurations that I've shown you and most of the systems I know of are not concerned with multiple consoles at the terminal. Now, there are multiple console systems, but they're of some fairly specialized and limited kinds. At our installation, we're very much concerned with the problem of multiple consoles at the terminal, not multiple consoles all going back to the same machine on independent pads. We're concerned with multiple consoles clustered around a terminal control processor, which supports these three functions, and then goes back on a single channel or a combination of channels to one or many machines, depending upon what these various users want. It's a complex beast. This box, which is doing the support work, is multi-programmed. It's got an operating system in it. And this is the one that Ralph referred to that we put up on the air in a preliminary form last spring, and we're still working to try and keep it under control. Some of the characteristics might be of interest. In its simplest form, it's an intelligent terminal. The local mini processor and special purpose processor facilities for providing the graphics function are shared by many interactive graphics consoles. The graphics consoles currently active can use widely different display mechanisms, that is, they can use refresh CRTs or storage tubes or video devices or alphanumeric tubes. It doesn't really make any difference, and in one of the last slides that I have, I'll show you our existing test bed and you'll see exactly what I mean. The graphics consoles currently active can use widely different display mechanisms. A majority of all of the connected consoles can be concurrently active. The current use of each active console can involve different display images than those being generated for all other active consoles. The terminal can concurrently obtain support for the graphics system application and storage functions from more than one shared main computer, and the current use of each active console can involve a different application on a different shared main computer. Making it all very simple, we have a multi-console intelligent terminal with the ability to independently and concurrently interconnect graphics consoles, graphics functions, and application and storage functions, so that in effect, in order to do, in addition to doing a hell of a lot of processing for graphics, that thing is a big switch. And I don't mean that in the same sense as the people at Carnegie Mellon are talking about the big switch, but it performs a very important switching function. All of the configurations that I've mentioned so far are either here now or being worked on now. There's one that I'd like to mention just briefly that addresses itself to the future. A hidden assumption in all of the existing existing configurations that we've talked about is that the user is expected to know something about the internal configuration of the total graphics system. It's not just a black box into which parameter names and values of the problem are entered and from which problem-solving results are obtained. The user is required, at least in almost every system I know of, to enter the identification of the shared main computer that supports the application function if he has a choice, the way in which to call upon the application function and the shared main computer through the graphics console, the type of graphic functions that must be provided to support the application function, and a lot of other things. Now, why be concerned with all those things? So what if the user has to know a few details about how to make it work? Well, think about it for just a minute. GE's got Mark III on the air, and there's Timeshare and Telnet and Cybernet and the ARBA network, and what I'm saying is that we're getting into a world of tomorrow which has network-based computing systems. And the characteristic of those network-based computing systems is that the resources are distributed all over the place. A user doesn't necessarily know where they're at. There may be very different kinds of machines involved. In fact, the resource might move from one machine to another, that is an application function, over time, depending upon where the owners of the resource want that thing to be. There might be multiple copies, one which is busy, or the one you've been accustomed to getting to, which is busy. Your data might be in one place, and your programs might be in another, and so on down the line. And, of course, this network might spread, as in the case of the ARPA network, throughout the United States, and in the case of Mark III from General Electric, all over the world. Well, you can't hardly expect the user to know everything about that kind of system. And so you've got to do something for him. And something that I'll be talking about at the National Computer Conference is the addition of this function to the design terminal, and we call this a recogniton configuration. It's a recognition automaton. And effectively what it helps the user do is pick out where in the network the resources are without the user having to ask for them. He states a characteristic of his problem and a characteristic of the processing that he wants to accomplish, and the recogniton does all the rest for him and sets the network up, sets up a virtual system. And that one hasn't been built yet, and if anybody knows of it being built, I'd like to know about it. Thank you. Well, so much for configurations today and tomorrow. There are lots of problems with interactive graphics. The various configurations have limitations. They have all kinds of difficulties, and they have costs. Let's look at limitations first. The standalone configuration, as I mentioned earlier, blocks the non-graphic user. The system is totally dedicated to graphics while it's on the air. Now, you say, so what? Well, graphics are expensive, and for many people who will acquire a graphics system, an economic justification must be generated in terms of not only graphics use, but non-graphics use of the processor which supports the interactive graphics capability. So that begins to be a very significant thing. And you either have to have a problem which is very important to solve, and you don't care about the cost, or you must have a very, very, very high return problem in the interactive world in order to deal with that kind of configuration. The simple I/O device, you don't know what's going to happen to your response. There's no local control. You're totally dependent upon whether or not the mainframe is loaded down or not. And in general, because interactive graphics is so dynamic, and most systems people like to provide a very high response rate to it, what they do is they impose a very high priority in the operating system to pay attention to graphics. And what that does, of course, is it ties the non-graphics users up in knots again. And so one has to be very careful on how you configure those things. The buffered I.O. device, well, that one can drive you crazy. You've got a little bit of processing locally, and you've got a lot of processing remotely. And a little bit of processing locally to the graphics console gives you very, very good interaction rates for things that are just putting data in or getting an immediate echo of that data back. And that goes along very well. And so if your process is highly mixed in terms of entering data in, getting that data echoed on the screen, and also getting some computational support, but that computational support is remote, well, you've kind of got the user torn in two. He gets real fast response to the input-output function and highly variable and often crummy response to the compute-bound problem. Barry Boehm and some people out at RAND did a study, which I think was published last year in the Spring Joint. And they said, what if we deliberately locked the user out? By lockout, they meant that they took this interaction rate and this instantaneous response and they slowed it way down. And they'd slowed it down to like minutes, 5 and 6 and 7 minutes. And there were people who were banging on the consoles. They were so mad. It turns out, though, there's a very funny property. The quality of their work improved, even though they were led away in tears. And you can really put the guy into a box if you're not careful about that. And you've got to know what you're doing, or your systems people have to know what they're doing when they set up that system. And maybe you want a resident psychiatrist. I don't know. There are basically no graphics limitations on the intelligent terminal design, terminal or recogniton configurations. But remember, they're all remote systems, and so they are dependent upon the computer support from a mainframe, and in that sense, they're no better off than a teletype. But don't let that mislead you. There's a great deal of processing going on locally, and one may not have to go back to that mainframe very often between service requests, and that can go a long way towards reducing that dependency. There are a number of difficulties associated with these configurations. Everywhere except in the standalone systems, or perhaps even there, you're going to be plagued by data communications problems. If the graphic functions are partitioned between local processing and the main support computer, you've got a headache there. And if you've got limited hardware because of a limited budget or whatever, and you've got a sophisticated requirement as far as the visualization that you're going to have in interactive graphics, there's another set of problems there. Let me treat them one at a time. Let me talk about data communications and interaction. As I said before, one can use telephone lines at 10 characters a second or 30 characters a second or 1,200 or 2,000 bits, 2,400 bits, 4,800, 9,600. Coax at 40.8 kilobits per second. You got enough money to buy from microwave links, you can get those too. I suppose you can even use lasers. Mother Bell is probably going to sell that pretty soon. And I think it'll work. But for each one of those things, you've got something else to worry about. There's an effective data rate and a provided data rate. The provided data rate is the bandwidth of the channel, measured in whatever bit rate the channel provides. The effective data rate is the provided data rate less all the control information that one needs to put into that data channel in order for the sender and the receiver to know what they're talking about. Now, this is the notion of protocols. A guy knows that he's going to send three sync characters and then a start of text, and or a start of header and a start of text, and so on. He looks for his three sync characters and a start of header and start of text if he's dealing in a character-oriented system. Well, those five characters are essential to the communications process, but they detract from the effective data rate of that channel. So there's an effective data rate. Now, that's an upper bound on the rate at which data can go in and out of the console. Now, there's a requirement that the console has for dependent upon the type of interaction it's supporting. Number one, there's a certain amount of information it must generate outward from itself in order to let the supporting processors know that there is an interaction occurring and that some servicing support is required. Then there is a data rate required in to accept the results of the servicing support and to generate the response back to the human user. Now the sum of those two had better be less than the effective data rate. The degree that they are less than the effective data rate of the channel will determine how easy it is to communicate. Now there's a very fancy kind of expression, and I thought the interaction quotient when it was acronymed down to IQ was clever, but maybe you don't think so. In any event, what we're talking about here is these are the different kinds of interactions that occur, and it's relative to whichever type of channel they occur on. As I said before, there is the effective rate of the channel for the particular interaction. There is the output rate that the console has to generate in order to let the servicing system know that an interaction is occurring and what it is. This is the input data rate that the console has to receive in order to collect the response. And, of course, all these AI says that this is all very, very subjective as to what's most important to you or what's most limiting to you, so that every one of your types of interactions are biased. And when you take all of these all together, what you get is an expression like this at each point for the A sub I. Now, I don't claim that you can figure out what those all are yet. I know in our system we haven't. But we know they're there. We've seen the limitations on them. We happen to have a display processor, and right now we're trying to increase the effective rate at which we can communicate between the display processor and a general purpose mini processor. The rate we've got is pretty good, but not good enough for what we want to do. So it can be fairly complicated, and those may be pretty hard to get at, but when you get this kind of an expression, that kind of gives you a summary for a console and a configuration is how good the interaction is going to be just based on that data communications problem. Now, I've been talking about the problem of limited graphics hardware, and we've mentioned refresh CRTs and storage tubes and video tubes and so on. And some of you may have heard about LDS1, the very sophisticated device from Evans and Sutherland's computer company, or the Adage terminals, or a number of others. Vector General's got a very sophisticated system. And these are all in hardware. They're ones that either may be there or could be there, and I suppose if you gave any budding genius 5 minutes, he could figure out another one to put in if you could afford to build it. I guess it's pretty clear that these are all oriented towards text, and those are towards drawings, and this is towards image manipulation, regardless of whether they're text or drawings. And sometimes they're there, and sometimes they're not. And various of the problems that you may care to apply interactive graphics to may or may not require these. But what happens if you do require them? How do you crank this into your estimate of goodness or badness of a configuration? And so what we've done is try to summarize that again and suggested that if each of these F sub I is a visualization feature of the kind in the previous chart, and the B sub I is a weighting of how important it is to your process, then the F sub I can take on three values. 0 if the feature is absent in the hardware. -1 if it's absent and it's extremely important that it be present. And 1 if it's available. Now, one might ask, why that tremendous bias of a -1 over here? And the answer is, if it's really important, you're going to have it. And if the hardware doesn't give it to you, then you're going to have to approximate it with programming. And that software is expensive. It is not only expensive to generate and debug and put on the air, but it is expensive to use in terms of the processing time required to give you that visualization feature. And so your overall cost, effective cost, of the use of interactive graphics will go up if you must have a visualization feature, but it's not available to you in the hardware. Therefore, the heavy penalty. And again, the B sub I are the subjective weights. Okay. Now, not all the costs are always thought of by everybody who says, how much does a graphics systems cost? There's more than the terminal involved. And I've tried to list out here, at least for myself, what I think are all of the various potential cost factors in any kind of graphics system configuration. You notice down here I've got that little last one, the hardware, the console hardware, which most of the people focus on. Now, not all of these will occur, and if they do, not the total cost of each one of these necessarily applies to the graphics configuration. Some of them might already be there for another application of the shared computer which you're accessing. In which case, to be objective, one should try to prorate how much of what percentage of each one of these is applicable to the graphic system and is there strictly for its purpose. And that's a non-trivial task too. But if one's going to really do an effective job of estimating cost, then there's where you've got to go. Now, the IQ, you know, I said any bright young Tom Edison can put another hardware feature, another visualization feature into the hardware. And there's kind of a law of diminishing returns. After a while, you can dump an awful lot of money in, but you're not getting very much back out in terms of effective gain. And this simple little picture tries to illustrate that point, that in the world of data communications, even though theoretically we can communicate right up to the speed of light, in practice, there is a kind of a threshold someplace. And as we approach it, the effective gain we get back for more money dumped in to increase that ratio that I showed you before, that diminishes, and so the gain drops off. There's a similar kind of characteristic for graphics capability versus cost. I might point out here that as you have to approximate the visualization features which are not present in hardware through software, this curve will flatten out, and you know, you'll reach the asymptote way out here someplace rather than sooner. And of course, the more you have in the hardware, the faster this thing will come up to the potential barrier. There's that other direction. I don't know about your management, but my management says the more things cost, the more of a song and dance I've got to do to get the money. And that's what this tries to say here, and it's particularly true about graphics, since they're not yet impressed the fact that it's the most important thing in the world, like I believe. And then there's the problem of productivity. What is productivity? I asked one of my managers to explain it to me in terms of our organization. He told me to go get a cup of coffee. It's hard to guess what productivity is, and it's even harder to know. Some people refuse to even try and say what it is, because then someone else can look over the shoulder and say, you're not being productive today. But if you can, and I suggest you should try, when you try and estimate whether or not and how you're going to put in interactive graphics, you're going to find something that you're going to latch out to, which is a measure of your productivity. It might be the number of designs per day or per hour or per year, or the number of layouts that a technician accomplishes, or the number of simulation studies you perform, or what have you. But there will be something which is accomplished in many units over time. And productivity is precisely that, the way in which you can change that value upward or downward in terms of applying graphics. And again, you've got to put more capital in order to get better productivity. There might be some wrinkles in this curve. It might vary up and down, but the general trend will be this way. And there generally is an asymptotic function in each area. Whoops. Well, the major point that I've been leading up to is to try and combine all of these things, try and gather together the impact of interaction quotient to the degree of graphics visualization features built into the hardware, the amount of dollars one has to spend in software and hardware all over the place, the kind of data communications, and how many consoles you've got, and try and come up with a nice summarizing approach to what can you expect to gain. And that should be your question. What can you expect to gain from the application of interactive computer graphics? Computers in general, and interactive computer graphics in particular, I view as an amplifier of human capability. The amplifying function impacts quality of results, quantity of work, the amount that's accomplished, the cost effectiveness of the methods, the efficiency of the effort, the minimization of elapsed time, and a variety more that you can think about. Amplification in this sense, then, incorporates dollar costs, usefulness, and satisfaction. And as a consequence, I've chosen an overall figure of merit that I've called the degree of interaction, or the degree of amplification. And I've kind of symbolized it as a factorial, and again, we have an awkward expression that describes it. And factorial has been left off. Belongs right there. All right, but basically, this is your productivity measure. There's the IQ expression, which we generated before, the graphics capability. That's dollars from all your sources of cost that I listed out before. C is the number of consoles in your system. Since not all of these are equally important in every kind of installation, and since many of you will have different thoughts, the W sub I represents the subjective evaluations that you place onto which is most important. I would note that if you just isolate on the productivity factor all by itself, and you look at change in productivity over time, effectively what you've got is kind of an acceleration, so that one can use this in many ways. Now, Jim Foley, who's now at University of North Carolina, has done a lot of work in simulating various graphic system design alternatives. His doctoral thesis was in design optimization of different types of systems, and he developed a cost effectiveness measure, which was a function of wait time and think time, and that kind of measure of responsiveness was done purely in terms of the hardware costs associated away from the main shared computer and only in terms of the console costs. In my view, that measure is very useful. It's kind of an upper bound on what you can expect out of graphic systems, but it's more like brute force capability rather than actual utilization capacity. It's kind of like add time and memory cycle speed as other kinds of figures of merits of the computer. And I think I would highly recommend you to consider that and perhaps this as well. Together, they can hopefully help you. Let me conclude with a few remarks. I caution you against the overzealous use of this formula or any other. Deciding whether or not and how to implement an interactive graphics system will require many other considerations. For many applications of computer graphics, there may be no other reasonable way to satisfy an essential requirement. Therefore, a graphics system must be implemented. The remaining question will only be as to the system's capabilities and the kinds and so on. Also, an application may dictate the need for a particular visualization feature that it is built into the hardware. You might not have any choice. And therefore, the choice of graphics consoles is reduced to only considering those which offer that feature, and you have to eliminate the others. Finally, it should be pointed out that the expression for amplification that you're looking at is not an exact measure. It's highly subjective. There's weighting factors throughout it. There are some very tough things to try and get a handle on inside of it. It's a figure of merit, and it's an approximate indicator. It presumes the assignment of value ranges to factors that may be very hard to measure or even express analytically, and it's open to subjective bias. However, if you handle it carefully and you use it along with some other good things like good horse sense, it can provide an indication for use in the evaluation and choice of interactive graphic systems. Now, Ralph said I should show you our configuration. And, whoops, wrong way. There we go, that's the kludge. That upper box that says remote computers, that's not part of the terminal, although we like to think we control it all. And the bottom part that says NC facility, that's not part of the terminal. But everything else is. That's a terminal. The Datacom controller is a special purpose processor. It's really just some logic and a little bit of buffering. That's a 32,000 word Variant 620F. There's a big display processor which handles these three big tubes. These are refresh CRTs with their data stored in the memory of the Varian, and this box gets it out and drives them. That's a storage tube device with a video scan. That's a straight storage tube device. This is a refresh CRT with local buffer storage. The reason for the dotted line is these are unordered and we haven't confirmed them yet. These will probably be some kind of a video or refresh CRT. There's a lot of other kind of input-output associated with it. We're in the graphics business in many ways. There's the electrostatic printer plotter, onto which we will be able to take the output off of any one of these devices and put it directly one for one. Or if that's not good enough, we can go down here into this Tridea system, which is a automatic drafting system that handles up to E-size military drawings, and we can get a big high-resolution drawing out of it. We have a few computers that we're connected to, and as I pointed out earlier, eventually any user can be working to any one of these machines independent of what any other user on the system is doing. They can be working to different applications, have different images, and when I said it had a big switching function, I meant it literally. The operating system is the killer here. We have a couple of versions that have been going. Working on another version. The other hard problem is that a user might one day decide, well, he doesn't really need all of this power over here, so he might come over to one of these devices, which offer him compromises. There you can get very, very high data density without flicker. Here you can get interaction without the slowness of response of a storage tube, but not the high resolution or the data density. And then the next day he might go over to, or next session he might go over to any one of the other types of systems or devices. In which case then, internally here, we've got to be able to support referencing the image data from any one of these devices, regardless of what it is and how it was presented. So the notion of a virtual device and a virtual display space and standardized procedures for describing imaging programs and image manipulation programs are all problems in here. Also, since we go back to so many different types of computers for so many different usages, we must have some sort of a uniform way in which we leave the system and re-enter it so that we just don't get ourselves all bollocked up in having to write specialized this and that for every application on every different computer. It's not all operational. The dotted lines tell you what's not operational. Even within the things that are not dotted, the full capabilities that I mentioned to you earlier, the design terminal portion is just this again. It's a subsystem in this overall capability. We're adding the features one at a time. We already have had all three of these devices on the air at one time with different images. We've had these two going through the system concurrently with these three. They weren't doing anything terribly impressive, but we were impressed because it was damn hard to get them to do that. I guess that's about all. Oh, I might add one other thing about what we think is graphics. That little box down there says an NC shop. The Army gets terribly concerned with things like weapons. And weapons are terribly concerned with all kinds of higher dimensional geometries, shock waves, energy penetration characteristics as a shell fragment goes through a piece of armor, the shape of the nose of a piece of ammunition, and so on. And one of our groups within the Army Materiel Command is concerned with three-dimensional surfaces, which are, I won't say sculptured, they're just there. They might be analytic and they might not be. And he wants to do something. He wants to see them. He wants to be able to put one up on his desk and study it. So what he does is he generates some sort of an analytic or numerical approximation. And we generate it up here on the screen. We copy it out down to this system. And from there, we post-process. And then we machine a three-dimensional piece, which comes out. And the designer, the scientist, has now this sculptured surface which he can set on his desk and ponder towards whatever lovely problem he's trying to solve. And that's graphics too for us. It's hardly interactive, but it is graphics, and perhaps the most extreme case. I think that's all I'll say for the moment. Thank you very much.
Bob, I want to thank you very much for an excellent paper. It helps us greatly in structuring our thinking and adds an awful lot to the basic understanding that's necessary to approach the systems level problem. Now, I'd like to introduce Rene Bosquet from Lockheed in Sunnyvale, who's going to change the tenor and the tempo rather drastically. He was graduated in 67 from the University of Santa Clara, and again, a mathematician. He's working in structural analysis at Lockheed.
What do you mean by that again?
Sorry about that. I'm an engineer, fellas. It's all right. Yes. Which would you prefer? Would you like to question the speakers individually and then get on to the next one, or hold them? How about we do it now?
I don't know whether the last slide applied to all the interactive graphics, but the main important thing about
they are, but they don't have to be. The question was, are all the devices in one room? The tubes all happen to be in one lab. At the moment, anything that goes through that datacom controller doesn't have to be even close. It can be any place that the telephone lines can reach, but the big CRTs have got to be within 2,000 feet of that display controller, and the display controller has to be within about 6 or 7 feet of the variant. Pardon me? Well, because we do an awful lot of hopping back and forth in the development of the software and some of the interfaces between them, and I guess we're kind of lazy. There's no real systems reason, though. It's just
are you educating people at this facility to use this?
Yes, we are. We have a nice arrangement. The Army always has volunteer guinea pigs, and some of our people in the laboratories and other productive directorates of the command have problems that they're doing with us in conjunction with our development. And they're willing to try and get whatever service out of the system they can in the interest of seeing their problem put up on the graphic system. We're delighted to have them because they're live users with real problems. And without too many exceptions, they don't pressure us to have the response yesterday. So that we're working with real problems in a variety of areas, yes.
Have you had any experience with having facilities located at the guy's desk, for example, as opposed to putting them in the room?
No, we have not.
You made a comment that as the time between response and initiation for the graphics interaction increased, the guy's quality of the input was improved.
In a problem-solving environment, that was the case where the user could productively take advantage of think time, if I may use that term, between responses, it turned out that the quality of his work went up. On the other hand, in specification processes, where the major point was to use the graphic system as a layout assistant, if you will, his quality increased up to a certain level and then kind of flattened off and then dove down rather dramatically as the response got too slow. Too fast was no good, and too slow was no good. And there was a rather narrow peak where you crossed over that between the two. But in the problem-solving environment, quality improved rather dramatically with rather significant lengthening outs of the interaction time. I've seen a couple of studies. In theirs, they ran it out as far as 5, 6, and 7 minutes, and between authorized returns to the user, or between the time he could enter something new into the system. That's where they locked him out. They deactivated his console effectively from the system. And it began to show very quickly as one got beyond just a few seconds. One showed a rather statistically significant improvement at responses still less than a minute, but very much more than just 2 or 3 seconds. And then there was another breakpoint around 3 or 4 minutes or so, and then there's another one for about 5 minutes or so, and they correlated with the level of difficulty of the problem. Again, the principal author was Barry Boehm, B-O-E-H-E-M. It's referenced in the paper, and it was published last spring in Spring Joint.
Thank you.
was done at RAND using their video graphic system. Yes, sir. Yeah, I'll be talking about it in another 2 months. It's an idea. It basically, one of the things that I've been involved with before is linguistic information processing. The problem of knowing what a statement of a problem means is a linguistics processing problem. The problem of building a device which can implement that analysis and then turn around and do something about it for you is the process of building a program or a machine. The recognition automaton is based on some theoretical work done in the early 60s by a man named Eugene David Pendergraft, who was at the University of Texas. And he worked in an extension of some theoretical work done in the early part of the century by Charles Morris on semiotic theory, which is based upon a philosophical point of view of Charles Peirce. And semiotics, very simply, is a sign process. And Pendergraft was concerned with automating the problem of specializing a sign process. Well, what's a sign process? An arrow is a sign process. It tells you direction. And the arenas in which we use that sign process are air traffic control and piping and wiring and fluid flow and transportation and communication, and they're countless. But they're all the same sign process from a philosophical and logical point of view. And from a large point of view, they're all specializations of that same thing. Well, the recognitan concept is based on a way in which to implement Pendergraft's ideas in specialization of a semiotic in order to take a linguistic statement of the problem you're trying to solve and the process you wish to apply to it and find the resources in a virtual network that can be coupled together to provide a computing capability to support the problem-solving process. Yes? Pardon me? I'll tell you in about a month or two when it's completely installed. Our use of it is on a comparative basis, principally. Again, I'm a tool builder, and what we do mostly is generate techniques and system concepts and configurations which we spin out to the people who are really doing the productive work. And so we're mostly concerned with knowing how well that type of a device fits into the kind of configuration we're interested in having, and how much of the kind of work we have in an installation like ours is appropriate for that class of device. And this is an economic choice. And so what we'll mostly be doing with it is trying out every possible application we can on it to see where users get happy and upset and where it gets very expensive and it's done well and so on, and to establish some sort of a measure of appropriateness, if you will, for that kind of a device in our kind of configuration. Our users will take advantage of whichever way we provide the applications for them. We have no preconceived ideas of any limited use or not. Yes, sir.
In the beginning part of your talk, you pointed out that because you don't like function numbers and spells and so on, you might consider using graphic or like circuit analysis.
Yeah.
Now, how much of a keeping cost if I think you might go to the spell? If I would choose to put a circuit, not a program, use a program, say,
well, in our kind of system, not much, because what we do is we try to function completely through menus for symbols and terms and expressions, and about the only thing that we really insist on the user doing is entering a number every now and then to quantify something. If he wants to be creative about labels and symbols and menus, he can do that too. So there's always a case for him to be able to expand online the library of terms, symbols, and whatnot. Okay.
If I am not in my own company,
yes.
And I currently have a terminal, what if I manage to say I must have a graphic?
Yes.
It sounds like I must have a graphic.
Yes.
How do I justify it? What do I gain and how much more do I pay? That's an application. I don't need a graphic to say to draw a picture. But
yes.
Design programs and such.
I can't give you a simple answer to that. I don't know a simple answer. The answer is based on what you're going to be doing and the requirements that you're going to be imposing on the graphics device, in terms of the kind of information you want presented and what you're going to do with it. I think the whole point of what I tried to say this morning is that there is no simple answer. It's a very difficult answer Too often, the answer is reduced to simply dollars of the console. How much does it cost to buy a tube, put a data communications modem in front of it, and stick it on some time-sharing system? And I claim that's not enough. In fact, it's almost dangerous. And I think that the 10-year lag time between the great hoopla for graphics and the still lagging enthusiasm in using it is due to just that kind of a problem, where too often people are lured in by the decreasing cost of the hardware and without an awareness of the full system costs. And it's not a simple answer. And I can't give you a flat answer on it.
Gentlemen, I'd like to break in now and introduce the second speaker so that we can complete his part of the program before the end of the session. This has been an excellent paper. If you'd like to continue a discussion with Bob, I'm sure that he'd be pleased to talk to you either immediately after the entire session or by some an appointment. Renee, as I identified before, I went to work for Lockheed along about 67, and in 70, one of his jobs was to develop a terminal that was used in stress computation to essentially control a much larger machine that did the batch work. And he's going to tell us with illustrations, particularly a film, the machinery that he has brought into being. He will follow, in a lot of ways, the things that were structured by Bob, but clearly there was no realization on Rene's part that the structure had to be done. His following, though, I think can be lined up with what Bob has told us rather nicely as Rene goes through. So.
We have a little administrative detail. You know, everybody's supposed to receive a card from the little lady as she came in and is supposed to fill the card out. Here's convention errors in the structure of the program to suit the needs of us. Yeah, well. If anybody doesn't have one, we have experts here.
No, it's fine. Good morning. Well, again, I work for Lockheed Missiles and Space Company, and I'm in the structural analysis group. And what this talk is basically for is just, again, to show you an application of how interactive graphics can help you, and hope that you can, again, apply it to your own specific needs, try and get a feel for how we interact and what it means to interact, and what it saved for us, and the approach we took in choosing the system that would be best for us out of all the different systems that Robert put forth. Okay, my group is responsible for the structural integrity of the Poseidon missile, the Polaris missile, the new Trident missile, and along with any other external applications that we do get in, such as the submarines and nuclear pressure vessels and whatever. The approach we take in analyzing structures falls into two main categories, what we call a finite difference method and a finite element method. Most of our programs are finite element programs, which means that the structure that we want to analyze is broken down into a series of little pieces. Each piece is analyzed separately and then combined to give an overall view of how the structure reacted. From this we get deflections, displacements, stresses, strains, and Well, quite a few years ago we started developing a large series of programs to handle these kind of problems, such as buckling problems and shell problems. And we found out very quickly that the type of data that's given, that's come out from the computer, is very large in volume. and it takes the engineer a long time to decipher exactly what did happen to a structure. So we started developing a large series of what we call batch graphics programs, which allowed him to graphically display on hard copy on an electrostatic plotter, such as the SC4020 or the IIIFR80, whatever machine you want, pictures of his model, pictures of his stresses, pictures of his different elements and what have you, to help him decipher exactly what happened. This is an example of sort of how the breakdown works. You start with what you want to analyze, and you break that down into a finite element model. And this specific model had 4,200 degrees of freedom. And running on a UNIVAC 1108 or CDC 6600 or 6700, this was taking about 45 minutes for one iteration of one load case. So you want to make sure that your structure is correct on input. You want to be able to decipher all the data that comes out on output as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So just to give an idea of some of the batch graphics routines that we started with, again, this is the type of a model that you might come up with. And what you're going to do is you're going to try and get stresses on the surfaces and the internal framings and spheres and so on. This is a part of a nuclear pressure vessel that we analyzed. Again, the graphics routines that we developed were to help the engineer in deciphering exactly what happened, and they range from such things as pictures of his model. In this case, these are nuclear reentry bodies showing the ablating of the reentry body at different altitudes and different times. Such things as isostress, isostrain, contour plots, stress cuts through any portion of the structure you want. And all these things come out, they're generated by the computer, and they come out with the initial analysis run. And you can just take these plots and put them directly into a report. Again, some different examples of some of the stuff we do. Elastic-plastic analyses for a given element. You can figure out exactly what happened to an element during a loading and unloading cycle. And again, these are batch graphics routines, which means that is yet we haven't got to the, quote, interactive terminal yet, but the engineer is just sitting at his desk, puts in a batch run, a deck of cards, or a Fortran program, whatever he wants, analyzes the structure, and comes back with these pictures. Well, we were finding that, here, just to show you that the pictures do come out with report headings on it, with titles, with labels, just and as many plots on a page as you want, reduced to different sizes, and you can put these directly into a report. So it is ready to go directly into an analysis report. And we essentially generate the entire production report on the computer. This is a collage just to show you the types of output that was generated for a single run. You're getting your basic model run on two different types of programs, an axisymmetric analysis program, a three-dimensional program, isostress plots, deflected plots, again isostress plots, stress cut plots through the structure, deflected plots superimposed on top of the undeflected structure, taking different increments of deflection and superimposing them on top of each other, what have you. Well, we found out that this is all well and good, but it was taking a horrendous amount of time to initially debug our structures. It was taking anywhere from 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and on some of the real complex models, it would take a month to debug the structure. And if you're going to run an iteration that was taking 45 minutes on a large computer, you're talking about $1,000 a run. You want to make sure that model is totally correct prior to the first run. So what we did was we found out that the initial jump into graphics eliminated a great amount of costs, both in computer time and in man time, by giving him this extra aid to display his results with. And we found out that by going to the interactive mode, we could cut down the cost even farther. He was able to debug his model in a single sitting at an interactive terminal. He could sit at the terminal, display his model in front of him. If it was wrong, he could interact with the computer, physically change the model right on the screen and have it come up before him again, check it, send it through the mesh generation schemes, whatever he wanted, and as soon as the model was finished, then he could have it analyzed. After the model was analyzed, he could bring the data back to the interactive screen and get your output plots again interactively, allowing him to, for instance, on the isostress plots, to vary the density of the contours, to change the different levels, to make sure he gets exactly which plots he wants to display, and get it in a minimum amount of time. So he was able to debug the structure in a day, a single sitting, or a couple days, which was taking him, you know, weeks before, analyze the structure that evening on a large computer, and then bring back his data and reduce it interactively. So he was cutting down both the time span for debugging his model and the time span necessary for data reduction by large quantities. Well, this allowed him to progress and actually attack the problem in a more detailed type analysis, to take different follow-up on more iterations or whatever was necessary. So we are getting a more sophisticated analysis coming out because of our graphics capabilities. Well, our approach in choosing the system we wanted was based on quite a few different factors, the main one being that we do run on a multitude of different machines for the actual analysis. Some of our problems are so large that the actual computing facility at Lockheed is not large enough to handle them, so we have to go off-site and run somewhere else. Well, we want to make sure that our system is not too dependent on which machine the actual analytical results are generated on. So what we did was we took our interactive terminals and hooked them up to a smaller CDC 6400 in a remote station from the actual analytical computer. An IBM 1108, a UNIVAC 1108 or an IBM 370 65 or a CDC 6600, 6700, all run on the average of around $1,000 an hour to run. And you don't want to be sitting necessarily attached to a $1,000 an hour machine running interactively where you're sitting there being charged that kind of time. So again, we were running on a smaller machine being charged on the average about $120, $150 an hour for doing our interactive work. We were running in a time-sharing mode, which means the machine had seven different control points all running at once. So you were sort of flipped in and out with seven other control points running both graphics and batch jobs. And you had the availability of communicating with your control point, allowing you to roll in when you needed the computer and roll out when you didn't want to. So when you were rolled out, your picture would stay on the screen, but you weren't being charged any computer time at all. So you could essentially sit there for an hour and study a single picture, a drawing, or model, whatever you want, recompute coordinates, and not be in charge of any computer time. So what I have now is a film to actually show the interaction, to give you a feel for actually how the engineer works with the central computer to change his model. So, and I just brought, this is the preprocessor showing how you just debug a model for two different programs, one an axisymmetric program and one a three-dimensional mixed element structure program. Again, the whole overall idea is to debug the model in as quick a time as possible, take your results, either output on a data tape or on a deck of cards or however, depending on what machine you're going to, take that information over to the large number cruncher, analyze the structure and bring your data back, and then interactively debug it again. So with that, let's go right into the movie. The movie is running. This is actually just a shot of the screen showing you just exactly what the engineer sees. It is running in real time, so what is happening is actually the speed at which it is happening. And go a little bit farther. The area we work in, you have the ability to for tape drives, card readers, card punch, and central scopes. You can communicate with the operator. You're on a very informal basis. The current system that we're working with, this is the Computec terminal right here. You're sitting here, you've got a keyboard, you've got a tablet, which allows you, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the tablet and the screen. You have an instant hard copy generator, which is probably, we felt, was a necessity, which allows the user to sit back, take a picture, just by pushing the button, and in 10 seconds, he's got a hard copy of whatever was on the screen. He can take that back to his desk, or sit back and study those results. And again, he's rolled out, and he's not being charged computer time. First thing that comes up on our screen is a series of programs, and the user inputs which program he wants to actually use, along with a series of commands for that specific program. So he chooses which one of these commands he wants to use, either by punching in the command in the lower left-hand corner or by hitting a series of function key buttons. In this case, this is a two-dimensional axisymmetric structure. The user inputs a grid pattern, which he wants to shape into the actual structure, along with reference points. He can then send this grid pattern into our mesh generation schemes, which will calculate internal coordinates given a boundary. We've incorporated an error, which is there's a straight line here instead of a curved line, just to show you how you can correct it interactively. You can superimpose nodal point numbers, element numbers, freedoms, whatever he wants, any time on any structure. So he can, knowing that there is an error, he can jump into the input tables and search the input table until he finds which one was an error. In this case, he's got a straight line instead of a curved line. He can then go into the central memory, change either the coordinate values or the line connectivity values, or add elements or add nodal points or whatever he wants. In this case, he's changing the line option from a straight line to a curved line. Go back, make sure that the old line got deleted and the new line got added at the end. Restart, he's punching in restart, which says, all right, take all the updated tables, anything I've added, recycle them back through the mesh generation schemes, through the element generation schemes, come up with an updated model, which has been corrected. To help him debug a structure, we've incorporated a series of different options available, such things as blowing up the structure, getting partial plots of the structure. A lot of times the structure itself has very high density regions where we know that there's going to be a high concentration of load or something. So you blow that area up to the full size of the screen, superimposing nodal point numbers and element numbers. Again, this is just another example of an axisymmetric model. Each element in this case represents an axisymmetric ring. So you're seeing just a slice through a ring, essentially. This being the actual structure that was generated from that IJ coordinate grid. And again, you've got a higher density of elements in here, so you might want to blow that up, make sure that those got in correctly. You have to be extremely careful in using these programs that your aspect ratio on the elements aren't greater than a certain factor, and you want to make sure that... Okay, so we can jump back now, choose a different program. In this case, he's choosing the mixed structure preprocessor. And the different commands available to him here are necessary because the model is now a three-dimensional type structure rather than a two-dimensional structure. You want to be able to spin the model around in front of you, look at it from different angles. The structure is made up of a large number of different elements rather than just one axisymmetric element. Do you want to be able to separate the element types out? What's happening here is he's pushing a button. He's in an auto mode, which means that the computer is calculating and shifting or rotating the structure in front of him for him, which allows him to just sit there and hit a button, and he can just flip the structure around, make sure that it gets in right in all different modes. Here he's limiting the element types to two specific types, which are the internal spars and what have you. Make sure that that got in correctly by itself, separate from the membrane plates or the bending plates or whatever. To show how an error can be corrected in this structure, we've incorporated basically a nodal point that's got in out of place. This is a toroid and a sphere intersection. Send it through the automatic mode until you find a view that shows up your errors as clearly as possible. Now he's found out that nodal point 10 was wrong somehow, so he can jump into the coordinate table, checking nodal point 10, find out that it got in as all zeros. You now hit a function key which will roll you out, sit back, recalculate the point, recompute the point. We have joystick or tablet options available, so you can actually go in and change the point manually and it'll calculate the point for you. Or you can input the coordinates, or the computer asks you for the X, Y, and Z value. It tells you what the old program was, or the old coordinate was. Again, send this back through and make sure that that correction was sufficient to correct the error. The order in which the model is being built up, in this case it started here and built around, is the order in which the structure was built up internal to the driving program. So we sort of got away from the attitude that you have to put in models and structures with data cards, and most of our structures, being geometrically definable, are generated using a Fortran driving program. So that as you see the structure build up, you know, and if all of a sudden someone just haywire, you'd know where in your program the structure went bad, and you go back and correct it that way. We have stop action allowing you to separate different portions of the model. In this case, this is a submarine hull tube intersection, launch tube intersection, separating the actual hull from the internal bulkheads and the tube, make sure that each section of the model got in correctly. And you get any of the orthographic views, XY view, YZ view, XZ view, this being the XY view. There are a large number of programs available, not just these. Stuff for generating circuitry boards, microelectronics. We have programs for footprint patterns for reentry bodies, decoy mechanisms. You can actually play war games. We have programs for that. To show that there is a versatility tool. Here you can pick a specific view, rotate the x-axis 3 degrees and the z-axis 30 degrees, plotting all element types. This being, say, a specific view that he wanted to see for a report. He wanted to physically put this in a report. You can now hit a button and whatever, another a function key, send this picture out to a magnetic tape, and that tape could be taken over to the electronic plotter, giving you a very high resolution picture directly insertable into a report. You can use a tablet for inputting three different points, which will define an area and blow that up to the full size of the screen, so essentially they're zooming in on a specific area. Again, if the model is still too dense or you want to zoom in a little bit farther, so that later, for instance, you want to stress cut through these elements here, you want to know what those element numbers are, you want to see the relationship between each other, you can input. Again, zooming in, get element numbers, and then you can take a stress cut later, which goes directly through these element numbers. And it'll show you what the your output hoop stress or output axial stress or whatever strain did in those specific elements. This is just another example of a model that we analyzed. On the output mode, you can get such things as any kind of a plot for, again, your stress cuts. This is just an example of some of the output quantities that you can get. We also get isostress plots, deflected plots, and they're not on this movie. Superimposed deflections, structures by themselves, superimposed, any magnification that you want. Take it back, it is on this movie. Okay, on the... Okay. What that was showing you that the once you bring the data tape back, the data tape is read in, all the information stored for the different increments of the different solutions, the multiple load cases are stored in equivalent spots, and then you can access them to bring up stress cuts for any load case, and deflected plots for any load case or contour plots. That's basically what our approach is. And to a specific problem, that is structural analysis. And I just hope that you can get a feel for how interactive graphics can work, and that maybe you can find some way of applying it to your own needs. Thank you.